What's up, guys? It's your girl Ginger, the true crime queen. I'm reminding you now that listener discretion is always advised. The dark nature of this show is not suitable for young ears or those that are sensitive to graphic material. But without further ado, let's get it. Welcome back, my loves. I know it's been a long time since I released a new episode. Quite a lot has changed on my end, but rather than wasting your precious time talking about all that, I'm just going to give you what you want, what you really, really want, a very long, much overdue episode covering one of the closest physical manifestations of Jabba the Hutt I have yet to research. I literally read, watched, or listened to every single source of information I could on this huge sack of shit, and seriously, the level of disgust we should have for this man is out of this world. This guy is nastier than the floor of a bus plaza bathroom, I'm telling you. I will have to cut this episode into two parts, but I will be releasing them both at the same time as well. Before we get into the timeline of this case, I want to address a possible area of confusion regarding his, like, title as the Happy Face Killer. Because there's also the infamous Smiley Face Killer, which you should know is theorized to be a completely different perp. The Happy Face Killer, aka Keith Hunter Jesperson, the ass face we are covering today, targeted several women while driving long-haul truck across the United States, whereas the Smiley Face Killer, who has not yet been identified and is believed to be targeting primarily white college-age men and is drowning them. Very different stories, but a very similar name because there's just not that much creativity in mainstream reportive journalism these days. And people like you and me know, after listening to all these goddamn podcasts and watching all these true crime shows, that some personality characteristics just scream psycho killer. And it's during my research on this case that I realize Jesperson nearly checks off every single stereotypical serial killer-ish trait you could possibly imagine. Even down to those stupid fucking oversized, slightly tinted serial killer style glasses, you guys. It's incredible how this man managed to get so far in his murderous routine before getting caught, because in hindsight, this man is nothing short of a walking, talking, homicidal red flag. So get your metaphorical serial killer bingo cards ready, because we're taking a deep dive on whom the media should have really called the limp dick doodler, which yes, I will most definitely be explaining as we move along the timeline. If you aren't familiar with this case, we have a lot to cover, including 8 victims, a survivor story, a totally random false confession, a series of narcissistic letters, and after 30 long years, we still have 2 different Jane Does that need to be returned to their families, which is exactly why we should be talking about this case. So, Keith Hunter Jesperson is one of those types of assholes that prefers to play more of the victim while consistently blaming everyone else for his shortcomings, and basically his inability to control his temper. He always acts as if every single one of the women he murdered simply crossed some invisible line that made it completely acceptable to take their lives. Unfortunately, too, it seems that some of these victims' stories have either been mixed together or retold incorrectly, because there's several different incidents during my research where some of the victims' stories have overlapped. I tried my best to figure out the most factually true circumstance to every woman's case. However, I also feel like, you know, when there's 8 victims in such a short amount of time, it's very possible that Keith has gotten some of his memories mixed up and/or he purposely switched details just to keep everyone 1 or 2 steps behind him. And honestly, either one could be true because this trash human being is a literal fucking bridge troll at times. So obviously, there's got to be a huge, huge trigger warning for some heavily graphic violence against women as well as animals. I'm really not kidding. This guy has done some things that I am just really not comfortable saying out loud on the internet, and that should tell you a lot. On the more positive note, though, there's still a very real possibility that someone out there listening might hold the key to identifying one of the last Jane Does to have crossed paths with this misogynist monster. So let's get in it, because it's going to be a long one.
I don't know when, I don't know how, but I'm back on my bullshit starting right now.
Keith Hunter Jesperson was defecated, born on April 6th of 1955 to father Leslie and mother Gladys Jesperson in Chilliwack, British Columbia, just under 2 hours from Vancouver area, for reference. I feel like it's rather rare to see this level of evil in someone who originates from Canada, but as someone who comes from the Pacific Northwest and all the psychos it's produced, I'm definitely not judging, just surprised. Keith happened to be born into a pretty large family. He was raised as a middle child between two brothers named Bruce and Brad and two sisters named Sharon and Jill. Keith was never particularly close with any of his siblings, from what I can tell, and later cites himself as the black sheep of the family, which really just boils down to being the weird one of the bunch, right? And like, yeah, that checks out. I mean, I didn't read an entire book that talked about any of them killing eight whole ass people, so I think it's safe to say Keith will stereotypically identify as the black sheep of the family. Coming along strong with that same cliche energy too, it shouldn't be much of a surprise to you that Keith's father, Les, was described as a hardworking World War II Navy man who had only made it to the 10th grade. Despite that though, he was said to be that hard-ass outdoorsman type who liked to drink and box when he wasn't turning wrenches, building something, or beating one of his kids with a belt. You know, those 50s dads could be brutal. From my understanding, Keith's father was naturally the rough and tough disciplinarian, whereas their mother, Gladys, was the more submissive, very prude. She was literally banned from the barn when the animals would mate or give birth. She's this church-going homemaker type that preferred to stay out of her husband's way and would like to knit sweaters in her quiet time. Mom Gladys would often try to intervene in Les's disciplinary moments. If Les had been drinking, that option was apparently out the window, and there wouldn't be much she could do to save the kids from their dad's belt. Keith would end up not being very close with his mother, though, too, and describes his father as both a superhero as well as a villain. His father did seem to be a very hard person to impress, which was seemingly a constant struggle for Keith. Growing up in British Columbia, Keith and his siblings would grow up with tons of room to run around and play outside in the woods, building forts and tunnels, fishing and bow hunting, you know, all that stuff. Their mom, Gladys, would have to use this special whistle to call the children inside for dinner time. Like, it definitely didn't come across as the worst childhood I'd ever researched for someone who would end up being this fucked up. Keith was reportedly even potty trained by the age of 2 years old, which is not what you would expect to hear for future serial killers. So, like, that's the one dark triad trait that Keith is missing. That's his only good quality, though, I assure you. Keith will claim that his earliest recollection to date was naturally of him ruining someone else's day. He told Jack Olson during interviews for the book I, Creation of a Serial Killer, that his very first memory was rolling a big rock down the slide, which, as you can imagine, ended up in his brother Brad's face, causing quite a bloody mess. And we're off to a promising start here, ladies and gentlemen. Keith remembers specifically by age 4 fearing his father and the use of the long, thick leather belt in corporal punishments. Keith recalls trying to hide under the kitchen table to escape it and would be told not to cry after these spankings or that he'd get it harder. But you know, I'm sure that didn't affect his foundational emotional development at all or influence a perpetual cycle of future violence. That couldn't be. You stop. Keith's father, Les, had once even encouraged a little Keith to simply pee on the electric fence as the standard practice of telling if it was on or not. So I think you can get an idea of like the toxic humor Keith is being raised with. One notably positive thing I could find about Keith's upbringing was that just as he was about to turn 5 years old, his parents brought home a tiny chocolate Labrador that Keith ended up naming Duke. And it proved to be one of the very few animals that Keith would consciously choose not to torture and or kill. Another would be a raven. Yeah, you heard me right. This creep befriended a raven on some Edgar Allan Poe shit. He even named it Blackie. I'm kind of surprised Keith didn't end up being a journalist with like that level of originality. Keith claims to have once attempted to mend this raven's broken wing back to health. So he brings the crow back home and suddenly Blackie is taken from Keith and placed into a makeshift cage where his brother and their friends had different plans for the bird, which included using it as target practice for a spontaneous knife-throwing competition. I am truly sorry I had to say that out loud. Keith went on to explain that he was actually really angry at his brothers for hurting this raven, so angry that he proceeded to go up to one of their rooms on straight-up berserker mode, just breaking a whole bunch of their shit in return. That was until, conveniently, their not-so-understanding dad came home to find Keith just tearing shit up, which naturally earned him a grade A 50s style ass whooping, leather belt and all, no doubt. Keith later makes a point to complain that his dad obviously didn't care about what his brother had done to Keith. That's likely because Keith's father also didn't really have much compassion for animals, as he would also often take his aggressions out on the free-roaming gophers and gardener snakes on the property. Learned behavior, I guess. And wouldn't you know it, it's almost like it was out of nowhere that Keith also grew to love hurting animals as he grew older and obviously more desperate for his dad's attention and approval. Keith would eventually be gifted a slingshot and a BB gun along with his brothers, and together they began terrorizing the community as a clan. Keith once shot another neighborhood kid in the penis with his BB gun. That would have been it for my kids, no more BB guns. On another occasion, Keith apparently slung a marble at an unsuspecting older woman doing some gardening in her front yard who just happened to be bending over at the time. To give a better sense of how Keith's dad's humor works, apparently this woman came over, obviously complaining to Les to punish Keith over nailing her with a marble, but his smart-ass dad instead goes, "Sorry, ma'am, I'm gonna need to see the evidence first." And that was one of the few times that he had spanked Keith with his bare hands rather than his belt. Going easy that time. A belt would get pulled out for more appropriate ass beatings, like the time that Keith had reportedly stoned one of his father's beloved ducks to death. So, you know, you pick your battles in parenting. To be clear though, almost any and every animal that wandered onto the Jesperson farm between 1959 to 1967 was unknowingly playing Russian roulette. Keith and the boys would reportedly find pleasure in force-feeding Alka-Seltzer to seagulls, using stray pets as target practice, tying neighborhood cats together and watching them fight to their deaths, and later implementing the use of firecrackers and bleach injections on some Jeffrey Dahmer shit. Often the family would end up with several feral cats around the property that Keith would learn to consider nuisance animals. Keith admitted that his father had once caught him in the act of strangling one of these poor cats, but never once did anything to stop it. Because of this, Keith said he basically felt encouraged to continue doing that shit because in some really gross, fucked up way, Keith believed it was making his father proud. It's very possible because Keith's father, Les, seemed to have a pretty fucked up sense of humor, honestly. Keith would later implement the addition of fire into his dark triad list of hobbies, noting that a can of hairspray or a butane lighter will make any and all flames bigger. Keith and his friends once wound up burning an entire house to the ground during this period of being a straight menace to society. As Keith would grow old enough to enter grade school, he was reportedly enrolled in the Unsworth Elementary there in Chilliwack, where Keith would advance from putting his hands on animals to other schoolmates. By age 6, Keith found himself a self-proclaimed rival named Martin, who of course would always be the one to get Keith in trouble whenever they played together. Keith remembers being so sick and tired of this Martin kid getting him in trouble that Keith would end up cornering him and wringing the kid's neck while screaming, "I'm gonna kill you, you son of a bitch," with every intention of doing it before an adult eventually pulled Keith off. And I'm not sure if it's appropriate or not to judge a 6-year-old based on these actions, but I am. I totally am, yeah. Keith would earn those signature serial killer glasses by 2nd grade after consistently getting bad grades, as he didn't realize he couldn't see or read the chalkboard until age 8. And that I'm not judging so much. Keith reportedly shares a birthday with one of his brothers, interestingly, which would always end in some sort of comparison to what his brother would receive as gifts. Keith complains that they always had joint birthday parties too, and that they always seemed to be more focused on his brother, of course. The only good thing Keith remembers about the birthdays was an absolutely horrendous sounding cake that their mother would bake and then fill with coins. Yeah, like stuck coins inside the cake for the kids to find. And of course, Keith bitches all the other kids always found all the coins first, so unfortunately he never got the chance to choke on one, I guess. By age 10, though, Keith is ever progressing towards his first murder charge. Over summer break and while swimming at Cultus Lake, just south of Chilliwack, Keith was subject to another kid's torture for once, with him being held underwater for long periods of time before being allowed up for air, then forced back down again in some sort of like sick death game, it sounds like. That is, until Keith eventually went unconscious and was later pulled out by a camp counselor. Weeks later, though, Keith claims to have run into the same kid at the local pool, where he then sought revenge, forcing this kid underwater with full intentions of drowning him, before thankfully a lifeguard ended up ruining those plans, keeping Keith from being a bloodlusting murderer for just a tad bit longer. When Keith turned 11, he was able to begin delivering newspapers around the neighborhood, occasionally earning himself a few tips and building a bit of a savings. That is, until his father, Les, reportedly started making Keith pay $30 a week in rent money at age 11. And $30 a week in 1973 was like $200 today, so Keith's essentially paying the mortgage for his dad the way he makes it sound. And of course, he swears up and down that he was the only one of the children that ever had to pay some sort of rent. I couldn't tell you if that's true or not, but it's funny to think about, isn't it? It was then halfway through sixth grade that Keith would learn the family would be moving down to the U.S., as their father Les's engineering abilities would land them in the small farming community known as Sela, Washington, just a few hours south of the Canadian border. By this point, it's probably not a big surprise that Keith didn't make friends very easily as a preteen, but if Keith thought it was hard in Canada, I can guarantee you that American kids are going to be absolutely brutal. Keith likes to believe this social awkwardness has nothing to do with him being a big-ass crybaby who gets mad and strangles things, but rather everything to do with his siblings and classmates nicknaming him Igor from the movie Frankenstein. Or I like the much funnier option of Tiny, because Keith happened to be so much bigger than all the other kids his age. Fully grown, Keith is a hefty like 6'6" and anywhere from 260 to 300 pounds. So he's up there with other literal monsters like Ed Kemper and, I don't know, fucking Shrek, I guess. But you can imagine that he wasn't a small child by any means. He's big, he's slow, he's awkward, he's easy to pick on, and he gets super freaking mad when you do. So naturally, for the bunch of sixth graders at Sunset Elementary in Sela, Washington, Keith was just fresh meat. I suppose this is where we can put in the antisocial aspect of our serial killer bingo cards. But finally, though, Keith does end up meeting who he would consider his first friend while in the seventh grade. Keith remembers this kid, Tom, teaching him how to steal candy by hiding it up his sleeve, which eventually got them in trouble with the local cops. To make an example of the boys, the police then paraded them around the school in the back of a police car. And as punishment, Keith's father forced him to work for the store, hoping it would teach him a lesson about stealing, but Keith literally continues to steal shit until he's into his 30s, truthfully, so that went nowhere. Now, I'm going to put a trigger warning here for sexual assault, but I don't know how true this actually is, and not that we shouldn't always believe the victim, but you just cannot always believe Keith. And like many other stories we have covered about serial killers, we have now hit the point in the teenage years where the killer claims to have either been molested or narrowly escaped being molested. I vaguely remember Joseph Duncan having a very similar story, but Keith claims that while playing with some of the neighborhood boys at a nearby dairy farm, a male farmhand had brought the group to a barn where he then made them take off all their clothes and instructed everyone to touch their penises together, like some weird superhero handshake or some shit. When the farmhand went off with another boy, Keith ran back home and told his father what was happening, who unsurprisingly did nothing but tell Keith to keep it to himself and stay away from that dairy farm. On another occasion, Keith alleges that around the age of 14, which would have been like 1969, that while he and his father are out camping on a beach, an older woman somehow taught Keith the way of the birds and the bees. He describes feeling disgusted about the first time he saw her boobs, describing them as, quote, pasty white with dark blue veins, unquote. According to Keith, she later forced him into having sex with her multiple times throughout the night, but in his description of this, he clearly does not understand what the fuck forced into sex means. Obviously, that would have been his first experience with anything that even remotely resembled a woman by this point, never mind that she was apparently some random witch that had crept out of the woods or something. Again, though, why is this so oddly common with serial killers that I've covered? Why do these guys always have these weird-ass memories or fantasies or dreams, whatever they are, where they are the victims of women, but then they go on and grow up to kill several actual women in reality? Like, what's the deal with that? The shoe fetish slayer, or fucking Jerry Brudos, also said something very similar about a mysterious Japanese, or maybe it was Korean, woman that would sneak into his bunk at night and try to seduce him. Like, what? I'm sure, though, that local beaches in the Pacific Northwest circa late 1960s were probably just swarming with ladies looking to bump uglies with some awkwardly sized teenager named Igor. Sounds right. So if you had subconscious kink with blaming women for sexual problems on your bingo card, you can just blot that bitch out right now. When Keith is a junior in high school, about 16 years old, his father would end up shooting his beloved dog, Duke, citing it must have got into some poison because it had been dragging ass. Never mind it was like 12 or 13 years old or anything. As you can imagine, Keith was devastated by this and basically never forgave his father, and revenge is a long game because Keith would go on to silently abuse several of his father's small lap dogs for years to come. Not a single ankle biter was safe around him. Karma works in super funny ways, though, because I believe it's during his senior year at Sela High School and while on the school's wrestling team that Keith would be pressured into climbing a 25-foot rope that was hanging from the gymnasium ceiling, which he did, but when the rope inevitably broke loose, his 200-pound ass fell straight to the gym floor, no mat, no nothing, in front of his entire wrestling team. He reportedly landed feet first before slamming his head onto the ground, resulting in a pretty severe foot injury and possible frontal lobe damage. Keith walked around with a limp for months after this and later needed 3 operations on the arch of his foot. These injuries, along, of course, with Keith's D average grades, would then cost him his dream of ever joining the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Honestly, though, this is a 2-for-1 because now you can take your bingo cards and check off past severe head trauma, which science seems to agree can contribute to violent tendencies, as well as another common shortcoming of murderous men, the failure to become a police officer or some other form of official authority. Boom. By mid-1973, Keith would just barely graduate from Sela High School, later attempting to apply at the nearby Western Washington College with hopes of becoming a game warden. Turns out, though, Dad Les wasn't willing to pay the tuition necessary when Keith's wrestling scholarship wasn't available, and Les didn't believe Keith could handle college anyways. Nothing like having a supportive dad in your corner, right? Instead, Keith's dad had way better plans of suing the Sela School Board for his son's recent rope fall injury, while simultaneously using Keith as free labor in the newest family business venture, opening their own trailer park. Goals. Yeah. Soon, Keith was learning how to drive dump trucks, backhoes, laying concrete, and installing power lines for future tenants, all on a bum foot. When Keith is 19, he meets the woman who was unfortunate enough to become his wife, a beautiful 17-year-old girl named Rose, who happened to work at one of Keith's usual burger joints, known as the Lariat. Keith had come in for a chocolate shake and a burger and somehow eventually ended up leaving with Rose's number after asking several times over. Keith likes to describe himself as an extra large version of Elvis Presley or James Dean, but Rose says she actually didn't even find Keith particularly attractive, just annoyingly persistent. Okay, maybe I paraphrased like a little. How all of a sudden Keith becomes suddenly charming? Well, even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while, am I right? Honestly, though, serial killers be like that. Dennis Rader, BTK, he was married. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. Robert Yates, the Spokane serial killer. All these really creepy, cringy-ass dudes seemed semi-normal enough to marry at one point, and some of them obviously had kids. Like, sometimes these types of guys just end up being your literal next-door neighbor. And that, my friends, is the most terrifying part. After 9 months of dating, for some reason, Keith and Rose advanced on a marriage. From what I understand, Keith was only asking Rose because his dad was pressuring him into settling down, and Rose only said yes so she could move out of her parents' home. It was said that just 2 weeks before the actual wedding, Keith actually went to his dad admitting that he didn't want to get married, but Les, being Les, told him, "I've already invited the in-laws, don't be a disgrace to your family." Yeah. When that effort obviously bombed, Keith apparently tried again at the rehearsal dinner, said to be held at a Denny's Diner, the finest of family eating establishments. This is where he attempted to get Rose to call the wedding off by obnoxiously flirting with her maid of honor, even to the point of literally kissing this other woman, then having the audacity, the gall, the gumption to tell Rose, "Hey, she kisses better than you." And he lived to tell the tale. Are you kidding me? He lived. Despite that huge, blindingly obvious red flag, Rose would still ultimately become Mrs. Keith Jesperson on August 2nd of 1975, said to be in a small Catholic church in Moxie, Washington. Rose had just turned 18 years old and Keith was barely over 20. The following year, Keith and his father would receive over $33,000 for the foot injury lawsuit. Keith had plans of using this money to relocate himself and Rose back to Canada in Chilliwack. But Keith's father had other plans for the money and convinced Keith to reinvest it back into the family trailer park with the premise of being the manager, as well as allowing Rose in on the operation as their bookkeeper. The newlyweds would end up purchasing their own mobile home and parking it right next door to Keith's parents' lot. Tenants of the Silver Spur trailer park would soon be subject to Keith's distaste for their outdoor cats and fantasizing about what he would like to do to some of the younger female tenants, as he watched them change through their windows at night. Keith would eventually get so irritated while working under his dickheadish father that he would end up taking short trips out to rural areas just to take his frustrations out on what he considered were problem animals. Oftentimes it was a stray dog or one of the cats that the tenants had brought into the trailer park. Keith claims the power and control he would feel from doing this gave him literal hard-ons.
You should have kept that in. You should have kept that to yourself. Why would you let the whole world know that? Why would you open your mouth and share that? You didn't think that was between you and God?
This worked for Keith for a few years until the family eventually wanted out of the business and Keith and Rose would end up doing side jobs to make ends meet as they waited to have children. Oh, while we're at it, let's talk really quick about the semi-Josh Powell situation we have here. According to Rose, Keith's father Les would often and very openly hit on her, like flirt with her, even in front of Keith at times, though usually Keith would just laugh and leave Rose to deal with it all by herself. And I can't even imagine the nasty things he probably said to her when Keith wasn't around. But this shit apparently went on until Rose eventually got pregnant with their first child, like 3 or 4 years into the marriage. It should also be noted that when Rose began to gain weight from her pregnancy, Keith would trollishly make comments about her body and say things like, "You know, I really prefer the skinnier girls." And I literally cannot believe this man is the murderer sometimes. This could have very easily been a snapped episode instead. But Rose and Keith's oldest daughter is someone you might actually know. Her name is Melissa G. Moore, and she has made her way into the true crime community, bringing with her the perspective of being a serial killer's daughter. As a new father, Rose believed Keith was more or less afraid of the children, especially when they were newborns. He could only, like, manage to hold them for moments at a time before giving them back over to her. So as you can probably only imagine, Melissa's childhood was likely not like yours or mine. During later interviews with her mom, Melissa learned how her mother believes they had personally escaped death multiple times in incidents that could be traced solely back to Keith's doing, a lot of which occurred in just the first couple years of baby Melissa's life. Rose describes having to save herself and Melissa from multiple random house fires, some or likely all of which were caused by half-assed electrical jobs that had been done by Keith. On another occasion, Keith had apparently left something outside the house that somehow caught their entire lawn on fire. It was actually Rose who had managed to save herself and little Melissa before Keith conveniently shows up out of nowhere just minutes after the chaos ended. So Keith's arsonist traits definitely didn't just stay in his childhood. By 1981, Keith and Rose are due to have their second child together, a boy they would end up naming Jason after Keith's great-grandfather. And unfortunately, having a son did nothing to deter Keith from seemingly trying to kill his entire family in some quote-unquote tragic accident. Keith would just have to get more creative. Like, why not simply be one of those dads that just go gets milk and doesn't come back? You know what I mean? Like, if not, you will, because the next incident was evidently while on a family camping trip with two babies in tow. Keith had done some fishing, caught a few, and just casually decides to prepare said fish right there next to the cabin, which, you know, is a big-ass motherfucking no-no. And people from Canada do know that. And wouldn't you know it, the smell later attracts two large hungry bears who then attempt to break inside the cabin where Rose and the babies are sleeping. But again, surprise, surprise, Keith is conveniently locked away inside the family's car, safely outside the cabin and away from the danger. So I think it's safe to say Rose wasn't getting much help from him, more like the absolute opposite, in my opinion. Now, for some reason, all these incidents were still not enough to deter Rose from avoiding Keith altogether, because the following year, the Jesperson family would be welcoming their third child to the chaos, a daughter they had named Carrie. And trust, Keith didn't seem to be much better at this whole parenting thing as his family grew, but he did eventually get more comfortable hanging out with them and sharing his love for the outdoors. Rose is pretty clear that Keith was never physically abusive to her or the kids, just animals. And clearly, Keith's abuse was more mental and emotional. Rose still somehow manages to give Keith credit for always coming through for their kids with Christmas presents when times were tough, considering him to be a much better father than he ever was a husband, and I wouldn't hold that thought for very long. Because one of Keith's daughter Melissa's most often told stories would be when she was about 6 years old, after she discovered a young litter of kittens while playing in the cellar outside her childhood home. Keith decided it would be funny to pin these poor kittens up by their tails to a clothesline that Rose had set in the yard. This obviously traumatizes Melissa, as she helplessly has to watch this all go down. She ends up hysterically running to her mom for help, and upon returning, they find that Keith had so kindly left all the kittens on the ground, lifeless for little Melissa and mom to find. Like, how fucked up is that? She was six. Needless to say, Melissa learns her dad is on some major Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type shit, basically by first grade. On another occasion, Melissa and her brother made the mistake of giving their attention to another cat who had wandered into their yard when Keith promptly walked over and took that cat away. Melissa obviously starts crying immediately, knowing her dad's temperament with cats, but he actually makes the effort to ease their fears by nicely petting the cat, before suddenly holding it down with one hand and twisting its neck with the other. And to this day, Melissa has a very hard time being around cats, and probably always will, considering she's very likely re-traumatized every time she has to tell one of those god-awful cat stories, which is on literally every single interview I've ever seen her do. When Keith isn't busy terrorizing the neighborhood animals, he would find driving big trucks and being away from his dad and the family might not be such a bad idea. After training and earning his CDL, Keith begins delivering loads all up and down the West Coast, being gone days at a time before returning home to spend some time with the kids, and then doing it all over again. And occasionally, he would suggest that Rose or the kids attend him on some of his trips to see what it's like. Now, Rose actually agreed to join Keith during one of his road trips, but I don't think it went exactly the way she had envisioned. She recalled that while being stopped somewhere in Arizona and walking away from the truck, when out of nowhere, 6'6" Keith physically picks up Rose and literally tries handing her off to some random guy who's also standing there in the parking lot, while dickheadishly saying, "Here, you can have her." Rose only later realized that the random guy was actually a pimp and remembers riding the entire way back to Washington in silence. Really though, as soon as Keith became a trucker, he realized he could technically get away with all the sex he could feasibly pay for while out on the road. Because the only thing Keith likes more than killing cats is crushing pussy. Back at home, whenever Keith tried putting on the moves, apparently Rose would tell him to put it away or put it in a keyhole, which is now my new personal favorite line. Keith even goes as far as saying that the only time Rose ever was interested in him sexually was when she was trying to get pregnant, complaining that he's basically just a big ol' walkin' talkin' cat-killin' dick with legs, I guess. Poor guy. Once in 1987, while driving near Maryhill, Washington, along Highway 97, Keith pulled off to the side to offer a ride to a young girl walking along the road. He was getting pretty used to having females ride passenger in his truck. So she gets in and they start driving, and he admits to leaning over and feeling this girl up, who he estimated couldn't have been older than 16 years old at the time. She immediately jumped out of the truck because fucking ew. For a second, he considers pulling her back inside and forcing himself on her until he realizes she could already call the cops and have him arrested. He then bitches about not sleeping for an entire week over the paranoia, promising himself he wouldn't risk that ever again, and made a personal vow to keep it in his pants for Rose and Rose only. Though it's not long before Keith finds himself with blue balls, being that he physically can't fit his dick into a keyhole or get it anywhere near his wife after having three kids. Keith admits he became so sexually frustrated, he even stoned a cat to death in front of his own son. After that, he would make more of an effort to sneak away at night to do that sort of thing with the neighbor's pets, finding that he liked to drown or choke them before allowing them to regain consciousness, and just like the boy at the lake had done to him back in the day. Keith even admits being so pent up that he once beat his own children's dog to death because it had an anal gland problem that he just hated having to deal with. Damn, dude, that's, like, that is just your own child's dog? Come on. Eventually, Keith would give up on the vow he made to himself and Rose after finding several different women along his trucking routes that were willing to give him the time of day, for the right price, that is. Soon, Keith would be picking up extra loads just to stop in and see some of his favorite ladies, driving all through the night high as fuck on no-dose, Jolt soda, and chocolate-covered coffee beans on the regular just for a little bit of that sweet poutine pie. By the spring of 88, Keith found himself a woman that he considered to be his match, sexually speaking. Physically, I don't know. I doubt she was 6'6". As they get to know each other, he finds she is also married with children, but getting a divorce, and for some reason chooses to keep his wife and kids a secret. Soon, he was spending more time with her than his own family, and eventually brings her back home to Washington with him, dropping her off at a bar before returning home to his family for the weekend, where he will then end up telling Rose he wants a divorce on what I believe was their 13th wedding anniversary. Real nice. Rose wasn't surprised about the cheating, though. She had been receiving calls for Keith from random women for months by that point, and apparently acted as if she didn't care about the divorce, which actually pissed Keith off, funny enough. Rose and the kids end up moving over to Eastern Washington in the Spokane area with her parents, while Keith chooses to stay over in Portland, Oregon, where his girlfriend lives. After a year of dating this girl, he actually starts teaching her how to drive a truck so they can deliver loads together as a team, figuring they could drive and have sex literally at the same time if they wanted. It's like this man's dream come true, basically, until he realizes that she won't drive in bad weather, she won't drive through the mountains, and worst of all, she liked to thirst trap other truckers over the CB radio. That cootie queen. After a bit of trucking together, Keith and his new gal would end up getting laid off, sending them back to her place in Portland, Oregon. She would eventually pick up a waitressing job at one of the area truck stops while Keith struggled to find consistent work. It seems to me like she didn't like doing the sugar mama thing, though, because she evidently skips town with some other trucker, leaving Keith alone at her place, broke, bored, and butthurt. According to the book I, Creation of a Serial Killer, after a few lonely weeks go by, Keith says she finally called him at the house, but to his surprise, she basically told him to send her his half of the rent money or get the fuck out before calling him an asshole and hanging up. Which, like, I'm loving that. Evidently, though, this triggered Keith so much, he literally ran outside in the middle of winter to find a stray cat and strangles it with his bare hands. And I'm not loving that. Mm-mm. When she called later in the month, reiterating that she wasn't coming back to him, Keith evidently decided a stray cat just won't do anymore. It's about 2 p.m. on Tuesday, January 21st, when Keith walks into the B&I Tavern in East Portland, Oregon, and grabs himself a beer from the bar. He sits his huge ogre ass down, watches, and waits. It's then when he notices an adorable, brown-eyed, beautiful young woman with this huge, bright smile, a Miss 23-year-old Tanya Ann Bennett, who seems friendly and appears to be enjoying herself over at the pool tables. After watching Tanya play a few rounds of pool and noting that she's had a few beers, Keith decides to quietly approach Tanya and casually introduce himself. And because Tanya was likely tipsy and possibly feeling extra friendly, she actually gave Keith this big ol' hug out of nowhere, indicating to him that she would be an easy target. I read that during the birthing process, Tanya's brain had been mildly deprived of oxygen, which later resulted in issues with short-term memory loss and possible intellectual difficulties. As a result, Tanya reportedly struggled in school a little bit and was later considered to be a difficult child, which is bullshit. But because of that, she would eventually find her way into drugs and alcohol, like so many of us often do. But Tanya is nice. She's friendly. She's a social butterfly with this huge smile who basically just likes to spend her time in a warm place with friendly people listening to music, and shooting some pool over a few drinks. From the sounds of things, the girl wouldn't hurt a fly. After buying Tanya another beer, Keith doesn't stay long and actually decides it would be smarter to be seen leaving this bar alone, alibi-wise. So he finishes up chatting with Tanya, paying extra attention to making her feel like he's not a threat, and eventually makes his way outside the bar, loudly announcing his departure so people notice him leaving alone. Keith doesn't really leave, though. This is a long game to him. He sits outside the B&I Tavern and waits for Tanya to leave so he can reapproach her, asking if she would like to grab a bite to eat together. But never let your guard down, ladies. Not even for tacos. Because this is actually where Keith tries to get shady. As they're walking back to Keith's car together, he takes out his wallet and does the old, "Oh, darn it, I don't have enough cash on me" bit. "Why don't we go back to my place and I'll grab some more?" And I truly believe that Tanya was likely just too naive to realize that this was an absolute setup from the beginning, because she evidently agreed to go back with him to his place. I'm sure she realized the pickle she had gotten herself into, though, when they arrive back at his place and he's coming at her with those Netflix and chill vibes. Once again, Tanya, I think, being between a rock and a hard place of being propositioned by a man the literal size of a professional football player, then probably felt pressured into sleeping with him. I feel like Keith, though, was likely looking for any excuse to take control over this poor young woman. He explains that as they're about halfway through doing this no pants dance, Tanya had said something to the effect of, "Can you hurry it up?" or like, "Can this be over already?" which must have been like a sore spot or a common complaint for him, hence the first half of his new nickname, Limp Dick. Because Keith instantly becomes triggered, loses his shit, and just begins punching this girl in her tiny, beautiful face over and over. Remember now, Keith's father ran a boxing club back in Chilliwack. I'm absolutely sure Keith could throw some nasty bows without having the advantage of being almost 300 pounds. And Keith says between her struggling to get away, he's realizing things have already gone too far and that if he doesn't kill her, she's gonna go straight to the cops. What happens next has been written a few different ways over time, but from what I understand, Keith basically beat this beautiful girl to near death before using his fist to crush her windpipe. With the size difference alone, the entire scenario is just insanely unfair and must have been absolutely fucking terrifying for Tanya. After Keith is confident she is no longer alive, he then strategically decides it's the perfect time to head back down to that same tavern and fully establish his alibi of not being with her. He literally leaves her laying on a mattress in his living room while he goes out, making sure to have several different very loud conversations with other patrons sitting at the bar, very obviously not murdering Tanya, before returning home a few hours later. Keith then takes the time to carefully cut the portion of Tanya's jeans that hold her front button. I'm thinking because she likely didn't fully consent and his fingerprints are on those buttons. And because he didn't exactly know how he's going to move her body later, Keith then decides to attach a small white rope around Tanya's neck in the event that he might have to drag her in some effort to conceal her body. He then carefully places her inside his car to dispose of later, and returns inside to attempt to clean the blood off of the living room walls. Later that night, Keith plans to place Tanya's remains in an area he would end up revisiting dozens of times over the next few years with his children. Keith pulls off to the side of the road, and from the passenger side of the car, he then pulls Tanya's beaten body down a small, rocky embankment just past a popular viewpoint on the scenic highway along the Columbia River known as Vista House. From this point, Keith decides to head back west towards Portland, where he will purposely toss Tanya's little black purse containing her wallet out his window as he passes this huge patch of blackberry bushes along the Sandy River Highway, several miles away from her remains, hoping to throw off any subsequent searches.
We were drinking beer a lot that day. Took her home. I thought I was going to get lucky. Comments were made and different things, an altercation happened, and I struck her. I actually had hit her in the face, and for some reason, I just kept on hitting her in the face, and because of that, I feared going to prison for slugging her in the face and causing bodily injury, and so I killed her. And I put the body up there in the Columbia River Gorge. I had tied a rope around its neck, mostly to... I didn't know how the body reacted when you started moving it.
The following morning, January 22nd of 1990, It was a community college student who happened to be out biking early that morning, just 10 miles east of Portland, who would notice Tanya's naked body just off their bike path. Her cut jeans had been pulled down by her ankles while her bra had been pushed up to her chest. By this time, her face was so unrecognizable that a sketch would have to be released for the news to then share along with pictures of Tanya's clothes, hoping someone in the Portland area might be able to identify her for the police. Unfortunately, it would take over a week before Tanya's own sister realized the clothes looked awfully familiar and their mom would have to make the saddest trip ever down to the city morgue. Initially, homicide detectives believed, based on the severity of Tanya's injuries, that whoever did this to her more than likely knew her personally and probably wasn't a complete stranger. As the investigation into who might have harmed her is getting started, police would find that bartender serving Tanya the night she was killed had noticed her playing pool with a few different men throughout the evening, but couldn't identify them after the fact as she was a regular and Keith was not. It wasn't until 2 weeks into the search that detectives would hear from someone who inevitably takes that case in an entirely different direction. Now, at this point comes one of the weirdest twists in a true crime case that I have ever covered so far. It's basically a little side story in itself, but get this shit. When the initial news reports about Tanya Bennett's remains being found come out, there just so happens to be a 57-year-old local woman named Laverne Pavlinak who basically saw Tanya's unsolved murder as her own opportunity to get away from her much younger 39-year-old boyfriend named John Sosnowski. Apparently, Laverne had already tried several other ways to break up with this guy, who was described as both an alcoholic as well as abusive, even to the degree of falsely reporting him to the FBI for robbing banks. So when that didn't work in her favor, this woman legit went, hey, you know what? I'll just implicate the boyfriend in some horrible random murder he has abso-fucking-lutely nothing to do with. I can't even imagine how bad her situation had to have been to feel like this was a logical way to deal with a toxic ex. So, Laverne made sure to closely follow any and all of the news reports and articles covering Tanya's murder for almost a month before proceeding to call in a series of small anonymous tips to the police attempting to implicate her boyfriend in Tanya's murder. It appears, though, the person who spoke with Laverne over the phone had misspelled John's last name, and the tips never really went anywhere. So when this wasn't working fast enough for Laverne, she began calling into John's actual probation officer, essentially leaving a fake bread trail of clues, which he then follows and eventually comes to speak with Laverne in person about these calls she's making. While talking with the probation officer, Laverne lies and claims to have overheard John talking about quote-unquote wasting a woman in the gorge. Because that sounds like a possible lead, the police then returned to Laverne's home with a search warrant looking for anything they could find that would tie John back to Tanya's murder, only to find one single suspicious item, a shady-looking envelope with the words T. Bennett, a good piece, shittily written on the back. When police eventually question John about these claims and this envelope, he obviously denies all of it because he literally has nothing to do with her murder. He's never met her before. He doesn't even go to the same bar that they're talking about. So when that doesn't work, Laverne decides to wire herself up with a recording device before serving John a bunch of alcohol and tries to convince him during a drunk haze that he had killed Tanya and that she had helped him dispose of her body, hoping he would blindly confess while being recorded, which she would then use to frame him. Like, at this point, Laverne is getting desperate, right? And actually ends up going out and cutting the buttons off an old pair of her daughter's jeans, grabs an old purse, throws these items into John's trunk, hits the police back up to say she miraculously found some suspicious-looking items that were possibly connected to Tanya's murder. Naturally, police come over, grab the buttons, the purse, the recording, evidently have everything sent off for DNA testing, which naturally returned no matches to anything of Tanya's. Police can't trace the purse back to Tanya either. They're like, what the actual fuck, lady? Laverne's like, what the actual fuck, my dudes? In her 11th hour, Laverne then doubles down and begins implicating herself into the murder in this crazy attempt to get John arrested. She proceeds to tell police, never mind what I told you before, I was actually there on the evening John killed this girl. I watched him sexually assault her, tie a rope around her neck, eventually changing it to her being the one who was forced to strangle Tanya with this rope. Which, like, this woman is way too old to be telling lies of this magnitude, in my opinion. She's got to know this is so wrong on so many different levels. Like, obviously something is not right, right? And in the detective's umpteenth attempt to confirm what Laverne is now claiming, police then drive her all the way out to the area where Tanya's actual body was discovered a month and a half earlier. And they straight up ask Laverne to point out where exactly they left her body, figuring only the true killer would know, and so as to compare it with fact. She later says it was pretty obvious to her because of how the bushes had been cleared away and there was some tire tracks left over and even some crime scene spray paint left on the ground. But to them, she simply pointed straight over to the same area and says, oh, we dumped her body right there. And, well, evidently that did it. Case closed. Keith Jesperson, who?
I was puzzled. I'd say it was something that just caught me kind of like off guard, especially when I heard it wanted to confess to it.
Obviously, the boyfriend, John Sosnowski, is then blindsided, questioned, and even polygraphed about Tanya's murder, which I read somewhere that he, interestingly, failed. Like, could you fucking imagine? Sosnowski was then arrested on March 5th of 1990 for the murder of 23-year-old Tanya Bennett, based on the false confession and evidence produced by his very bitter ex-57-year-old Laverne Pavlinak. But when you play stupid games, you do get stupid prizes, and Laverne was also then arrested as his accomplice to the murder. Back over to Keith. By this time, Keith's girlfriend had returned back home. He's trying to lay low and make things work with her, but gets annoyed whenever she makes him babysit her kids. They begin fighting again, and Keith admits that he begins considering strangling her too, which signals him that he needs to, like, get out of there, like, yesterday. Eventually, Keith decides enough's enough and begins heading south, looking for any kind of temporary physical work that might distract him from having more homicidal fantasies. He apparently wasn't able to reinstate a CDL quite yet for too many prior driving infractions. So while driving to California looking for work, Keith would often dream about the next woman he could convince into his car and see what he could pull. If she was great in bed, he might keep her around. If she wasn't, he had plenty of ideas on how to deal with that too. On April 13th of 1990, just 4 months after his first murder, Keith pulled into one of his old truck stops, hoping to find one of the usual ladies he liked to see. Unfortunately, they were all at home that evening. Since getting his dick wet seemed to be a bust, he figured he'll stop into the nearby shopping center and grab himself something to eat for dinner. He goes inside, buys himself some celery and peanut butter. That's just the most serial killer snack I can think of. Then posts up outside in his car at 10 o'clock at night, just snacking on a celery, just being fucking Keith, I guess. When all of a sudden, he notices a young woman walking with a baby in her arms. A new mom who seems quite upset. She'd obviously been crying. Keith also claims she was drinking from a bottle of Jack Daniels, which I doubt, but he sees it as an open invitation to harass her. I know that this 21-year-old mom would likely tell this story in a very different light, but according to Keith, the lady was obviously drunk, so Keith actually straight up told this woman his entire name, where he was headed for work, figuring she would never remember anyways. She mentions she had just left her home with the baby after having some huge fight with her husband. Keith casually reveals he also has children and tries to relate with his own relationship issues. During the course of their conversation, Keith claims she ends up asking him to buy her some more alcohol, which of course he does. Nothing is more important to Keith than the premise of Punani. So Keith runs inside, returns with a 12-pack of beer, and offers his front passenger seat as a more comfortable place to vent her frustrations. After a few beers, the young mom requests a ride down the road to somewhere where she can hop out and pee, and Horndog Keith couldn't be happier the night is actually going this way. They drive up the road, pull off in a turnabout area, and Keith parks along a wooded tree line. Keith says the woman hands over her baby, who's not even like 6 months old at the time, gets out and pees right next to the car, which apparently struck him as a bit inappropriate. Really? Him? When she gets back in the car, he hands back her child, and then Keith takes a moment to relieve himself before returning to the car, where they continue to air their personal grievances to each other. Keith alleges that their conversation would ultimately turn sexual, and apparently taking the whole cash, grass, or ass thing a little too seriously, Keith decides it would be totally appropriate to just pull out his penis, hoping it might lead somewhere. Keith says everything was actually going just fine until her baby woke up and started crying, naturally just as he's about to finish. Sure, Keith. Which he says then sent this woman into some kind of moral crisis, and instantly their night is over and she wants to be taken back to the parking lot. Keith starts up the car. She believes they're about to pull out, and instead of putting it in reverse and backing out, Keith just begins slowly driving further into the wooded tree line. Like, oh no, oh shit, oh fuck. And before this woman can even ask what's going on, Keith slams this mom's face into his dashboard and begins forcing himself on her. Obviously, she starts screaming, which causes him to get overwhelmed, and he tries to silence her by forcing her into a headlock with the full intention of breaking this poor woman's neck. Like, she's fully aware of this too. She is doing everything she can to lean into his body, trying to keep him from getting the leverage he needs to do this. By this time, the baby's on the floorboard of the car, and Keith resorts to kicking at him in hopes it will distract the woman enough to gain control of the situation. When all of a sudden, Keith realizes that if he does in fact kill this woman, he will then also have the baby to deal with. Which, interestingly, Keith is not comfortable doing. Thank fucking God. So basically, out of nowhere, Keith just releases his grip, completely stops fighting, sits back in his seat in a complete 180 style mindfuck. Keith quietly puts it in reverse, calmly backs the car out of the bushes, and pulls out like he didn't just try to rape and strangle and stomp her baby out. Suffice it to say that it was likely in the most awkward of silences that Keith actually drives this mother and her child safely back to the original parking lot he found them in. And before she quickly exits the car, he cares to warn her, "Don't ever get into anyone else's car again because it might be the last time." And with that, he's off into the night thinking he pitied her while she's off to the police station because fuck that misogynist dick face. After the woman spoke with her local police, who were actually able to track Keith down fairly easily given that he had literally given her his real name and where he was heading during their more casual chat, it was only a little under 2 hours later as he's pulling into a Corning, California truck stop that Keith notices an officer eyeballing him while he enters the restroom. While walking back to his car, Keith is then approached by several officers, weapons drawn, and ordering him to get on the ground. Keith figures he'll just play it cool. This is all just one misunderstanding type of thing, as the officers tell him he's being arrested for assault from the Mount Shasta area. He then starts spinning the entire narrative to make it sound like this woman had presented as Blowjob Betty herself. And he basically tried saying that he just put his money where her mouth was, hoping the old Proud Boys Club would see things the same way. So he basically brags to them that she must have gotten upset when he blew his load in her face, and being that she was drunk, she somehow managed to wrap herself up in his seatbelt is all. He never tried to choke her, noting that his only mistake was letting a drunk married woman into his car. As the cherry on top, Keith tried using the fact that he told her his name and even brought her back to the parking lot safely as evidence that he had no ill intentions. Being that this ended up being more of a he said, she said situation, and his version of events sounded logical to them, they actually ended up letting him go with the expectation that he return back up to Mount Shasta and get this quote unquote misunderstanding taken care of, which he did. The Mount Shasta police were quite a bit less understanding of Keith, though, so he countered their hesitancy with an offer to show them exactly where she had instructed him to park, which ended up being one of the known local makeout spots. Keith then showed them the receipt for the beer he had purchased for them, as well as pointed out an empty bottle of Jack Daniels he said that she left behind. Like, things couldn't have looked better for him, honestly. Ultimately, though, these cops would end up releasing Keith too when the woman's husband began pressuring her to drop the charges. Keith was eventually charged with sexual assault, despite the cops letting him go at the time, and when he later failed to appear for court concerning those charges, a subsequent warrant was issued for his arrest. Likely without him even knowing, though, being that he was working out of town at the time. I think the entire thing did spook Keith, despite him being able to lie his way out of two police interviews, mainly because Keith then manages to stay out of trouble for quite a while after this. Instead, it seemed that he spent more time focusing on his kids rather than killing. After listening to his daughter Melissa's content, I found that Keith left many a breadcrumb for his children to find, leading them to consider their dad could possibly be a sociopath serial killer. Melissa recalls that while she would spend some of her summers driving up and down the coast with him, at times, Keith would just blurt creepy-ass shit out in these sort of, like, announcements of, "I know how to commit the perfect murder. I would tear the buttons off her jeans. I would wear different size shoes. I would separate the body from her belongings, blah, blah, blah." To which Melissa was like, "Okay then, my dad just really must love Murder, She Wrote or some shit." But the truth is that her dad just can't help himself. Narcissists just literally cannot shut the fuck up about their crimes. On another occasion, when Melissa was staying at her father's girlfriend's place in Portland, the same home he had taken Tanya Bennett's life in, Melissa herself had started noticing several random red stains on the living room ceiling, spending many nights thinking to herself how in the world spaghetti sauce would have gotten all the way up there, and only realizing years down the road what it actually was. On an even spookier note too, Melissa also claims that it was never very easy for her to fall asleep in that particular home when she visited her father, especially the bedroom that he had chosen for her, because she would continually feel someone or something reaching out and touching her, and sometimes even pulling her hair. The house was straight up haunted. Like, apparently several other people had also died in this place prior to Keith's girlfriend inheriting it, and then Keith murdering someone in it. Melissa says she would usually end up falling asleep in the hallway just to avoid that feeling of being touched, and when it came up with her dad, he just said not to pay attention to it because they play with his feet at night. Like, it's totally normal. Which, like, good though, because I hope this asshole is being tickled by ghosts even today. By 1991, Keith was eventually rehired by another trucking company, this time out of Yakima, Washington. Keith's girlfriend would soon also be joining him on trips, quickly reminding him how irritating she can be with her CB radio flirting. I bet what happened next was likely the last thing from his mind, though, as that warrant out of Shasta County had finally caught up to him. It was apparently during a stop at a weight check station in Iowa that Keith got mouthy with some female scale master, who then ran his name through the National Crime Information Center, and turns out he has a warrant for his arrest. Keith was then arrested and charged with first-degree sexual assault, while his girlfriend was allowed to continue on in the truck. Keith, on the other hand, was placed in county jail and waited for extradition back to California. It turns out, though, that California ends up reducing his charges to a misdemeanor, which would then, of course, not be enough to justify the cost of an extradition from Iowa to California. So essentially, the entire thing is dropped, and Keith is basically sent on his merry way yet again. And would it even be a true crime podcast if police or the criminal justice system somewhere along the storyline wasn't fucking something up, though? I don't know, maybe that could be a middle bonus section of the bingo card since it's such a reoccurring theme in these stories. Upon his release, Keith then calls up his boss, who then sends him the necessary money to purchase a bus ticket that would get him back on his way to Washington. It's apparently while stuck on this bus, though, that Keith realizes the murder trial for the two people who had been arrested for Tanya's murder was starting soon. And it's almost like Keith couldn't be any luckier in that regard or something. It's like the fucker is untouchable, yet he's weirdly jealous that someone else has taken credit for his crimes. Apparently, this is when Keith feels the best possible way to handle this is by proceeding straight to the nearest public bathroom, which happened to be a Livingston, Montana bus terminal at the time. He marches his big, gigantic ass right into one of the men's stalls, takes out his handy-dandy permanent marker, and furiously writes, with the most god-awful handwriting I have ever seen at that, "January 21st, 90. I killed Tanya Bennett in Portland. Two people got the blame, so I can kill again. Cut buttons off jeans, proof." Not sure why he skipped the words, but. And then later, while in Umatilla, Oregon, Keith wrote a second bathroom stall message reading, "I killed Tanya Bennett, January 21st, 1990, in Portland, Oregon. I beat her to death, raped her, and loved it. Yes, I'm sick, but I enjoy myself too. People took the blame so I can kill again. Cut buttons off jeans, proof." Like, he legitimately thinks this is going to be the beginning of some huge cinematic manhunt for him or something. But honestly, crickets, you guys, just like deafening crickets. Because, you know, everyone, especially men, who are shitting in a rest stop bathroom stall long enough to read the crazy shit written on the walls is most definitely gonna rush right out to the first fucking police officer they see to report this horribly written public bathroom confession anyways, right? No, because no one fucking reads bathroom stall scribbles and takes them seriously. Best believe, though, while awaiting her trial, Laverne Pavlenak did do everything possible to recant her previous false confessions, though naturally no one was buying it at this point. Even when news of these weird bathroom scribblings did eventually make it back to her defense team, the judge would still end up ruling them as hearsay, and it literally did nothing to help Laverne's case or bring attention to Keith. Every single plea for a new trial was also rejected, and by February 8th of 1991, 9 out of 12 jurors had believed Laverne Pavlenak was guilty of aggravated murder, later being sentenced with 15 years to life behind bars, which was obviously a whole lot more than she bargained for, but almost most unfortunately, Laverne Pavlenak just unknowingly, even unintentionally, paved the way for Keith to continue preying on even more vulnerable women. John Sosnowski, on the other hand, who was just completely dragged into this situation, and now seeing that a jury had just found Laverne guilty, it's becoming very clear to him that he could also be found guilty if he goes through his own trial. If he is also found guilty, he could possibly be looking at a death sentence for a crime he didn't even commit. So he opts not to go to trial. By March 1991, John Sosnowski ultimately ends up with a plea bargain of no contest to the felony murder and kidnapping of Tanya Bennett, landing him a life sentence with possible parole after the first 15 years. John most definitely attempted to appeal his conviction following his plea, but ultimately ends up exhausting all his options within the first 3 years of his incarceration. Back over to Keith. By the time he makes it back to Washington, he is promptly fired after his boss learns why he's arrested back in Iowa. But now, with John and Laverne behind bars for the foreseeable future, it essentially leaves Keith with a clean slate to continue on seeking out his next potential victim. Unfortunately, guys, this seems like a really good spot to cut for part one. Luckily, you can jump right back into place on part two, which is available right now. So what you waiting for? Go on, get out of here, go. And that was the tea. I hope you enjoyed my rendition of the story, and if so, please tell all your creepy-ass friends about it. You can find the sources I used for the episode in its description. And if you'd like to support the podcast, check out patreon.com/gingerthetruecrimequeen, where you can find even more of that killer content.